to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill and Brandon Maslin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with myself, Jennifer K. Hill, and my dear friend and co-host, Brandon Maslin. We are so grateful to have you back here for Get Yourself the Job, where we explore a 360-degree look at everything from A to Z on how to land and keep not only your dream job, but also to find your purpose. What is it that gets you out of bed every morning? So today we're going to be exploring a very interesting topic that I can't say we've explored, at least not for a long time in this show. And that's going to be 7 steps to six-figure success with Johnny Walker, who we're going to introduce you to here in a moment. Before I do, though, I do want to thank the people over at Markham Search LLC who sponsor today's show. They provide executive search, payrolling, as well as contingency search throughout the United States. So without further ado, let me tell you a little bit about who our guest Johnny Walker is. Johnny is an award-winning digital marketer and former executive search consultant from London Square Mile. Founder of the Executive Edge program, specifically aimed at senior and executive job seekers with one objective: to help them get their ideal job faster and for more money without having to sell themselves. Johnny is the only job seeking coach focused exclusively on executive job seekers and whose program also has 100% money back guarantee. Johnny occasionally swears and rarely sits on the fence and is always entertaining and educational. So Johnny, thank you so much for being here with us today. Glad that we're all able to get together.
Oh, I'll try and keep the Anglo-Saxon language to a minimum. But yeah, you speak to me about CV writers and recruiters, and sometimes a little bit of cheeky language does slip out. Welcome, everybody. My name is Johnny Walker. I'm, as you can tell from the accent, from England, about an hour northeast of London. And I focus on helping six-figure job seekers get their ideal job faster and for more money without having to sell themselves. Because let's face it, if you're a C-suite executive, you know, you can't pull out the whole, you know, I've got a dental appointment next Tuesday, I need to be off work for half a day, you know, and then go for an interview. You know, it's too obvious. So helping those guys get their ideal job is what I do for a living. What I'm not going to do today, though, is some random sales pitch dressed up as an interview. I'm actually just going to sit here and help as much as possible. So there's all sorts of things we can talk about. As you know, getting a senior job is not easy. And there's a lot of moving parts to it. And if you're going to get it right, you got to pay attention to all of them. So I'm here to help. Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Johnny, let's start with a negative to go to the positive. So what is the hardest part about getting a senior level job that you've discovered?
Do you know what? Jennifer mentioned it in the opening intro. Of all the people I meet, the number one problem I solve for pretty much every single one of them is knowing what their ideal job is. What is their purpose? Virtually all of them can tell you what they do for a living. I manage people, I manage budgets, I manage stakeholders, I'm the CFO, I've got this, that, and the other. But none of them can tell you why they do it. And at a very senior level, all businesses only do 3 things. They make money, and the posh word for that is revenue. They help cut costs. And if you think of the business we all drew as kids, is basically a factory with a front door and a back door. Revenue comes in through the front door, costs go out the back door. In the middle bit, you just got all that messiness, which I just call risk. There's operational risk, there's regulatory risk, there's IT risk, people risk. There's a whole bunch of people there managing that messy bit in the middle. And so you tend to be either helping a business make money, you're either helping a business control costs, or you're helping a business to mitigate risk, regardless of what your activity and job title is. Those are the only 3 things you do. And as soon as you understand that, then you can articulate a benefit of what you do to an employer. And most really senior people will bore you to tears with, I've got 10 years experience as a CFO. I've got an ACA qualification. I've got knowledge of finance 2.0. And no one cares. What's the benefit to me as an employer? I make sure you don't spend too much. How much money do I overspend before we hire you? Well, the last firm I worked for had a turnover of $100 million, and I helped them save $8 million in the first year I turned up. Right. You just spent 5 minutes talking to me about what you do for a living. Absent was any of that. If you just strolled in, sat down and said, I help you save $8 million on a $100 million turnover by running your CFO function effectively, I'd have the rest of the meeting with you. But most people don't. They bore you to death with the how of the job rather than the why and the how much.
Boom. That's fantastic. I think for years I did a training called Professional Brand. I've shifted to professional identity, but one, we got to a point of what's my success. Exactly what I said, Johnny. People, the companies only care about, no matter what they do, they only care about those three things, which is, you know, I called it effective was the only difference. But I said, how do you make them money, save them money, and how do you make it more effective? And what I like to say is they should have cared about it in reverse, like how do you make it more effective? Number one, save money too. But they don't. Most companies are like, save me. Make me, save me. But anyway, I love that, Johnny. That's brilliant. Jennifer, I saw you nodding your head. What do you think, bud?
Yeah, I love it. And for anybody who's tuning in, we're sharing a lot of free links that Johnny has graciously offered to us. It'll be in the show notes. So while Brandon and Jai were talking, I was just busy sharing those on the Facebook page, as well as a few other places. So Johnny, I couldn't agree with you more. We are kindred spirits. I think that that's what's missing for a lot of us, not just when it comes to job hunting, but when it comes to, you know, landing a big client, to being successful, we often bore people to death with the what, the this, and the that. And we don't talk about how we're going to increase what I used to call productivity, efficiency, and performance, or PEP. So yes. I love it, Johnny. If you could talk a little bit more, I would really love to deep dive today into a few of your seven steps to six-figure success. I think it's such an apropos topic that, you know, we all deserve to have six figures if we want it.
Happy to. At the heart of everything I do, I was in executive search for 15 years, and I handled the careers of six-figure people that entire 15 years. One of the things I didn't like about executive search particularly in the UK, it's different in the US, but in the UK, we have exactly the same number of recruiters, but we have 1/6 the size of the market. So we're basically 6 times oversubscribed, which leads to some pretty crappy sales behaviors to get your share of the pie. And I didn't really like the sales bit. So I moved into digital marketing. I wanted to know, how do you generate revenue without selling yourself? Because I didn't want to do the sales thing. And I studied management consultancy and accountancy and lawyers. And they don't have rooms full of, you know, phone jockeys smiling and dialing. So how do they get to make their money? And that's when I discovered inbound marketing. And I discovered that for 5 years. And I was mentored by a really good guy in Canada. And I welded my executive search career and that digital marketing career together. And I won some awards in both to focus very narrowly on executive job seeking. How do we get executive job seekers to attract their job in so they don't have to sell themselves? And having studied that and studied it and studied it and then tested it, we boiled it down to 7 steps. And those 7 steps are positioning, which is the posh word for the thing we just talked about. What's your ideal job, really? Yeah. You can't, you know, you can't just vomit up your entire career and then expect a hiring manager to pick through it all for the chunky bits. They know that you got to focus on one thing. So what's your ideal job, really? And that's positioning. And then how do you articulate that in a compelling way? Most people can't do that. And there's a hard-coded formula for that, which I got from Google, which I can talk about in a second. But that next step in terms of how you articulate it is messaging. So you've got positioning, you've got messaging. The next step after that is once you've got this nifty message, you know, an elevator pitch, whatever you want to call it, how do you get it out there so that the hiring manager sees it? We call that distribution. It's just, you know, distributing your message. And there are 4 big channels for doing that. And anybody who's seen you will know what those 4 channels are, because when you're a hiring manager, there are only 4 channels available to you to go and find a senior hire. You could look on a CV board. Most people at a, you know, 100K plus market don't get hired off a CV board. But perhaps if you're more junior, then you're going to need a pretty, you know, whiz-bang CV. Your LinkedIn profile, that's really coming into its own in the last 18 months since Microsoft acquired it. It's got some pretty funky things going on there. You've got recruitment partners or executive search consultants. But the number one channel for all executive job seekers is going to be their personal network, the people they actually know, as opposed to your digital network where you know their name and that's about it. And that's because if I'm hiring someone on over £100,000 a year, that's got consequences for me if I screw that up. So what I want to do is de-risk that hiring decision as much as I possibly can. And the first place I go is the people I know, my network. If they also happen to know you as an executive job seeker, that carries more weight than any of the other channels. So we spend some time fixing those 4 channels, which is distribution, so that whenever the hiring manager goes looking, they find you. Then you've got something really cool. Not all the jobs you see online that you think you might be able to do are going to turn out to be wonderful because, you know, not every firm is, and that's okay. You know, different people will thrive in different environments and we need them all. So that's not a negative. It's just aligning the right people with the right roles. And you can't tell online whether that's a good culture fit for you, whether you're going to really love it, or whether the job's just going to be a bit meh. So one of the things we do with the people I work with is we get them to identify 20 firms that they think they really like to work for, and then we make sure they get an interview at one of those firms rather than just anything they see online. And that's, we haven't got a nifty title for that, so we just called it what it is, which is Choose Your Next Boss. So I'll have to come up with a niftier title for it. But so you've got positioning, messaging, distribution, Choose Your Next Boss. And once you've done those things, you're going to end up in an interview. And then nailing that is a critical one. There's loads and loads of stuff on Google and out on the internet, hints and tips on interviews. So we don't do any of the basics. We're just doing the sort of big game-changing stuff, how to structure an interview. And I'll talk about the buyer's journey later. But there's a very powerful way of taking someone through a story before you ask them to spend any money on you. And that's called the buyer's journey. It's in marketing. It's been knocking around since the late 70s. But since we've been watching everybody online, we've been able to refine it and refine it. So now you can borrow that and use it in the interview and really nail it. If you're the right candidate for the job and they've come to you and you've aced your interview, then there's a pretty decent chance that you can negotiate your pay up. So we'll show you how to do that. Get yourself a five-figure pay rise. And then lastly, even if you've been offered the job and you've accepted the job and you've got a start date, things can still go wrong. Not every time, but sometimes. And so we have a last step, which is minor risks. What happens if the hiring manager leaves before you've started? What happens if they run out of budget and they need to rescind the offer? You know, so this stuff that doesn't happen every single time you change jobs, but some of the time, is the last and seventh step, just to make sure you start the job. Because this is my thing. You know, you've been for interviews where you didn't get the job, but you were kind of sanguine about it. Yeah, it really fit me anyway. I'm not that bothered. It's not going to be like that this time. If you've chosen a firm you want to work for and they've hired you for your core purpose on really serious money and you don't get that job, yeah, that's going to sting a bit. So we make sure we just don't drop the ball after the finish line. Those are steps.
Those are great steps. Jennifer?
Yeah, I want to backtrack for a moment. I know you said you'd get into it, though. I like to tap in intuitively and kind of see what matters most to our listeners and viewers, Johnny. Yeah. And the buyer's journey, I think, is worth delving a little bit deeper into that, because that's something that we're reacting. There's what I always called reactive versus proactive interviewing. And when we react during an interview, all we're doing is trying to dodge the bullets like the people from The Matrix, which, side note, Matrix 4 I just heard about is coming out, which I'm very excited about. You know, instead of trying to dodge the bullets, you know, how do we be proactive? How do we actively, proactively participate in the buyer's journey so that we're not just sitting there hoping it goes well?
Cool. Do you know, I'm absolutely going to borrow that, if that's all right with you, Jennifer. And then my next post on LinkedIn is going to be the Matrix bullet dodging scene. And underneath, I'm just going to write interview questions, because everyone gets that, don't they? So thanks for that idea. The buyer's journey has been knocking around since the late 70s, and it is a marketing thing. And it's basically the order in which you present information before you ask someone to make a decision, normally to buy something, which is why it's called the buyer's journey. And it's in pretty much all marketing, from ibuprofen tablets to, you know, management consultancy gigs and everything in between. And there's eight steps to it. Audience. So who are you talking to? Problem. What's their problem? Pain. How much is it hurting them? Transformation. What's the win? If they were solving the problem, made the pain go away. Education. Why can't they solve the problem right now? Authority. And which is why you. Social proof, what other people thought who got you to do it for them in the past, and then call to action, which is just, you know, hire me. And so there's this eight-step process, which is in all marketing. You know, I don't know if you have this gel in the States. It's called Voltarol gel. It's basically an ibuprofen gel where you put it on your back pain. Yeah, you ever seen that? We got an advert in the UK, and it cuts to an old lady sat in an armchair looking wistfully out of her window into her back garden where her grandchildren are playing. And she's got back pain, which is why she can't go and join them. And so it opens up with, you know, are you someone with back pain? There's your audience. Yeah. What's the problem? Would you like to be joining in with your family? Which they can't. Pain. Are you missing out on important things? There's the emotional trigger. Transformation. Wouldn't it be better if you're out there always involved rather than held back in your flowery armchair in your living room? And so there's the win for it. They can get out there. Education, it's because you're swallowing a tablet, it's taking too long to metabolize. Instead, you've got this Voltarol gel, you can slap it on your back and it goes straight to the part that's painful. So that's the education there. Authority, we're a big, scary pharmaceutical company. We've been doing it for 25 years. Social proof. This is what, and then they cut back to the old lady who springs up out of a round chair, runs out to the back garden, kicks the ball. We play soccer in the UK, so it goes into the net, and she turns around and goes, goal, at the camera. And there's the social proof. It worked for her. Call to action. Get it from all great pharmacies right now. You've heard this advert in 10 different guises for all sorts of different products. It's the buyer's journey. And you can apply the structure of an interview. You can bring that structure benignly to bear on a hiring manager. You text that they want about it, but that's basically it. You know, rather than sit there and answer the question, so Jennifer, thanks for coming today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, or why don't you walk us through the last 5 years of your CV, or tell us about the last time you did a job that's a bit similar to the one you're interviewing today, which is a really dull question and doesn't get anyone anywhere. It's the height of hiring manager ineptitude. Not their fault. They don't get any training on how to be a hiring manager. All right. Instead of that, nod, smile, and say, yes, happy to do that, which is a colossal lie. You're not. It's a dull, dull question. Don't get anywhere near answering that question. Instead, say this, to help my answers be of much relevance to you as possible, perhaps you can help me understand what the big challenge facing your business is right now. Or if you know what that is already, yeah, because it's in the press or you've been briefed by a recruiter, you can say to them, perhaps you can tell me what your perspective on the big challenge facing the business is right now. And they will tell you about their problem. Then you can ask them how it makes them feel, and they'll tell you about their pain. And then you can tell them, if we were successful in solving that, and we're a year down the road, what would that look like? What does a win look like? And they'll tell you what the transformation in their business would be or their personal lives would be if that problem was solved, and so on. You can just bring them on in steps all through the buyer's journey until the end, where you just sit back in your chair and say, that sounds fascinating. It's absolutely my sweet spot, and I'd love to help you out. If you want me to do that for you too, let me know. And they'll buy. You know, right at the end, you've got to give them an opportunity to buy you. That's the thing that pretty much everyone misses out, the call to action. But you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves. There you go. Buyer's journey.
So it's interesting you use that advertising methodology because, you know, I partner with a lot of CMOs in the world, and my wife does PR. And so, you know, when you're putting out an ad, right, you have all these people in a back room basically figuring it out, and you're putting out there and whatever experiences. You get into these rooms, and even at the highest level, C-suite executives that I know, or people getting their, you know, second or third jobs, it's easy to get off course, right? I mean, to use that metaphor of the dodging the bullets, but it's also confidence gets affected or doubt seeps in. And so I find that I just talked to someone today who made a giant career shift. And the one issue we worked on was their ability, as is so often with lawyers that I know and software engineers, same issue, to dissect a problem, but they use that internally. Yeah. And they go, well, I'm not that great at this, or I'm not that great at that. Right? The ad of the woman isn't going, well, we're not great at solving this. We're not great. They're not doing that in the ad. They're going, we're good at this. Here it is. So I guess my question to you, Johnny, is how do people stay on track and don't deviate or get off message too far where they start that self-sabotaging behavior, which I've seen a lot in my work, and you probably have, and I know Jennifer has as well.
Yeah, and we've all seen it, and we all do it. You know, none of us are perfect. I'm a coach, and guess what? I have a coach, and there's a reason for that. I sometimes forget to take my own medicine. You have to look what the underlying reason is. If it's something as simple as you're just not used to it, then the answer to that is just practice. All right, role play it out. All right, get some practice in beforehand. I've got an interview coming up. Grab a buddy. Get some sticky notes on your screen, because we're all interviewing digitally nowadays. So the other person can't see that you've got a crib sheet on your screen. You can stick your yellow sticky notes all over the screen and practice it. All right. If there's something else there, but you said self-sabotaging behavior, if there's a reason for that, that's about confidence, it's about belief, it's about self-esteem, I'm about to run a masterclass on that, because some people have been out of work for quite a long time. And there's some fear there that they might not get back in, particularly the six-figure crowd that I work with. They tend to be 45 to 55 years of age. And there's some fear there that maybe that was the last job they've ever had. And you know, they're not going to get back in. They're not going to do anything meaningful. And so, you know, we have to address those issues. And I'm in a specialist for that. I'm not a mindset coach. I'll actually bring one in. We have two, actually, Sarah and Peter. Sarah is around confidence and resilience, and Peter's around mindfulness and wellness. He's a former armed forces veteran. So he's helped bring people back from some really tough places. And he knows how to get inside your head and ask the questions that unblock the reasons why you've got the fear, which might be as simple as, I mean, I was a high status individual 9 months ago and I haven't worked since. Fine. We just need to get you back, back in the game mentally. So it depends what the underlying reason is.
Well said.
Practice or help is the shorter answer.
No, that's right. I think practice and persistence. Yeah. Jennifer?
Yeah, I'm so in resonance with what you were both discussing. I think that our mental attitude, which we've done many episodes on in the past, does have a direct correlation to how effectively we're able to bring our consciousness to it. I think that what we're saying to people is don't go unconscious in your interviews. So many of us were out there and it's like you're like a deer in a headlight. So it's like, you know, before they even tell us about yourself, people are so in their own heads. And so I think that the more you can have play and fun, and we even did this right before we came on today, and we do this often before this show, is set an intention. Be clear. How do you want it to go? You may not get the script, quote unquote, exactly right. It's about having just an idea of how you want it to go, who you want to be. You know, and the key takeaway is that if somebody was sitting opposite you in an interview or a business meeting, how would you want that person to be left? And so take us through some of the next steps, Johnny, because I think this is such a beautiful, comprehensive look at what it takes. And this is all very applicable for non-six-figure jobs or even for 8 or 10-figure jobs. I think it's all
equally relevant. And I've dealt with some FTSE 100 executives, which is kind of similar to the Fortune 500, 8-figure earners. And, absolutely. And when you're internal, Brandon was mentioning that internally, you know, whenever you're talking about really big stuff, there's not a ton of detail about it, you know, big programs, acquisitions, you know, people on six figures don't have small jobs. They're all quite complex, but no one wants the detail, right? So you can use this sort of buyer's journey just as a sort of a top sheet, just to give them the stuff that they want, that they trust you with the details. It's the top sheet they really want. So buyer's journey works there too. If you want to ask your boss for $10 million to go and do a thing, use the 8-step buyer's journey and just hand that document to him. You get it signed off more times than not. Anyway, who's the most aggressive interviewer of politicians in the US? You know, who gives people a really grilling about their hard time? Who's not remotely sycophantic?
Rachel Maddow, maybe. There are probably people on. That's fine,
Rachel. So imagine a politician going on to one of these political talk shows who's going to face one of these interviewers who's going to give them a tremendous grilling. That they are not going to go in there without a game plan, right? They're not going to go in there and wait to hear the question and then come up with an answer. They're going in with something to say, regardless of whether they get asked about it or not, okay? And so, the question comes out from Rachel. Can you please tell me, Brandon, as Secretary of State for Family Values, why you should keep your job when you were found stumbling out of a rent boy's apartment at 4 o'clock this morning with your trousers around your ankles? Now, clearly, the politician doesn't want to go anywhere near that question, all right? That's got absolutely no upside for them whatsoever. And so you'll hear the politician say, Brandon, I don't think that's the real question. I think the real question is, and then they just go on to ask themselves the question and answer that, okay? So you have to have that game plan of taking and this is an extreme example because you're not going to have that kind of a wrestling match in an interview, but you know, you're going to have a structure, a place where you want to go, as Jennifer was saying earlier. You've got to know what the outcome's going to be. Okay, so that practicing of the 7 steps and the buyer's journey is necessary so you can sit down and benignly control the interview from behind and wind up in a much more constructive result for both the interviewer and for you. Because otherwise, you answer questions like, tell me about your career. Tell me about the last 5 years. Give me an example of where you failed. Tell me what happened last time you had the goalpost moved on you. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? Where do you see yourself in 3 years' time? You know, this is an absolute puke fest of a questionnaire. Doesn't get anyone anywhere. You know, just you need something much more constructive than that, and you can bring that to bear. And in fact, if you're a senior individual interviewing, I would say it's your responsibility. You know, you have it's down to you to do it, actually, because the hiring manager might not be able to. They might not have had that training. So, okay. If you want to know more about the 7 steps, there is an ebook which Jennifer's put the link to. It's just called 7 Steps to 6 Figures. And there's about 30 pages. It's a nice, breezy read. You'll get through it in about half an hour. There's no fluff there. And I would just urge everyone just to absorb all of that, and it'll make a huge difference to you. It's completely free. Yes, you'll end up giving me your email address, but no, I'm not going to spam the heck out of you. I don't do that. So help yourselves to that, please. You want a deep dive into something in particular, Jennifer. Is there anything there that you think would be really helpful to our listeners? Yeah, do you know what? Tell them about this, Johnny.
You know, what I'm aware of, and Brandon, what about you? Do you have any thoughts before there's something?
I just want to hit on one thing that he was talking about, and then let's divert here, but it's that interviewer, right? Yeah. And so I want to, you know, I don't know much about Brandon other than I love the sense of humor, but, you know, I listen to like that Graham Norton show. And I think it's basically because he gets all the US actors that just sort of come out of their shells, right? And I only mention this because a great interviewer is going to do one thing. They're not going to read you their list of questions. They're going to ask you a question that is directly related to the statement you just made. This is good advice, by the way, I always say. This is from a Match.com study, funny enough, on how you get a second date. But I think it's a great study on how you get a second interview or why someone would want to come back and be interviewed by your company. Yeah. And I only think about that because part of your seven steps is find the boss, right?
Yeah.
And I just think about that as such a good point, Johnny, that you want the boss, if that's who you're interviewing with, to actually deviate from their 10 questions and ask you a different question.
Yeah.
And if you've done that as an interviewer, you've succeeded. But I would imagine if you get that question as an interviewee, you're more likely to be engaged. I just think, just as a non-segment, it's a little deviation. But yeah, it's a good point about what makes a great interviewer.
Yeah, most people are not great interviewers.
Right.
Not because they're, you know, inherently bad. They just haven't had the training. You know, one minute you're a, you know, you're a 6-7 figure boss of a business division. Next minute, one of your senior people who's on 6 figures resigns. So now you've got to go and hire another person, like you didn't have enough work already to do this quarter. And so you've got to try and squeeze in some extra capacity to read CVs and do first interviews. And, you know, there's a whole, you know, it runs a coach and horses through your schedule. And so you say, you press the button, HR, get me a job description. Someone sticking out as an advert. Someone call a recruiter and get me a load of CVs. And then you go and interview people. With what training? With what support? With what help? None at all. And so what you're doing is just kind of winging a little bit on experience. You're winging it a little bit based on what interviews you've been in, good, bad, and indifferent. And you're hoping, along with perhaps, you know, some questions that HR suggested you should ask about strengths, weaknesses, and who knows what else, that's enough. And it hardly ever is. The amount of poor hiring decisions that are made is stunning. And the cost of your business is huge. And 18 months down the road, after not really doing anything major for your business, that person leaves and moves on. And your business has blown up 18 months worth of time, which is the most expensive thing, on not moving forward, plus X hundreds of thousands of pounds in salary. And that decision reflects badly on you. And that may, depending on how senior that decision was, may hold your career back. You know, Brandon's gone home and told the family, "Woohoo! You know, we're all off to Cancun for 2 weeks in the summer because I'm getting my bonus." And then you blow it on some hiring decisions, and your bonus doesn't quite come through as much as you thought it was. And now you got to go somewhere that, you know, less cool. You know, it can impact. It can impact you in all sorts of ways. You know, Brandon, you were doing so well, and then you dropped the ball on the hires this year. So let's talk about promotion next year, eh? And so it's from a hiring manager's perspective, getting this right is huge. And never mind the job seeker, you know, learning as a hiring manager makes a huge difference to your business.
Yeah, that's the perfect segue, Johnny, to what I was just going to tie in, which is you talked about this last step, the call to action. Mm. And I'm going to throw in there this idea of negotiating. Let's say let's talk about a job for this moment rather than negotiating raise. But let's say you go in. You've nailed it. You've gone through the buyer's journey and you've realized, hey, I'm here. Parity in what they're willing to pay and what you're worth. So let's say that they're like, you know, Johnny, you're right. You've got exactly what we need. And, you know, but unfortunately, you know, with things with COVID and yada, yada, we have £120,000, whatever budgeted for it. And we can't meet your request of 150, you know, so, hey, you want the job. How do you negotiate that?
So, there are two things to do here. One is the tactical answer, which I'm going to walk you through in a second. So everybody get ready to record this bit because there's a very high value negotiation script, which I'll share. But the first thing is to notice that the way we run the program is that you don't apply for a job. Yeah, you don't chase a vacancy around the block with your CV in your hand saying, please, I beg you for an interview. You know, they come to you. All right, we get you found for your ideal job. You don't sell yourself. They start buying you. And if they found you, which is where most unadvertised vacancies are, right? You can't sell yourself to a vacancy you can't see. So you've got to get found for those vacancies. So if they found you for the job, they've called you in, you've articulated some kind of benefit of hiring you, making the revenue go up or the costs go down and an amount to that. And during the interview, you've done the buyer's journey and you walk them all the way through to the point where they want to buy you. At this point in time, and I've sat in on hundreds and hundreds, possibly 1,000 interviews. I was very unusual in my executive search career. I would not allow new employers to me, new clients, to interview any of my candidates unless I sat in on the interviews, because I couldn't tell whether or not they're any good at doing the damn interview.
Wow.
So if you wanted to be a client of mine, I was going to be sitting in the corner of the room. I obviously wouldn't participate in the decision because I have a vested interest in that, but it did make sure the process was good. You know, you'd hear some really odd stuff like, yeah, we can't hire that guy. Did you see his shoes? I'm like, no. Okay, you absolutely cannot make a decision about hiring that person based on their shoes, right? Do you hear? He supports that sports team. We've got too many of those sports fans in the office. We're not having another one. Like, no, that's absolutely not criteria for hiring someone, all right? You know, you can't say that. So I'd keep them on track from an integrity perspective until I could trust them that they would do that well, and then I'd let them go in solo interviews. So I sat in on a lot. And here's the thing. Let's say you're hiring me, Brandon, yeah? I want 150, and I'm a, I don't know, what would you hire me to do? IT, finance, ops?
Right, let's say finance.
Finance. You're running a $50 million, $100 million business, doesn't really matter, and you want to trim some fat from the business, and it's up to the new finance person to go find it and persuade the hiring managers to do it a bit leaner and save you some money. Some multiple of seven figures. It's going to be below $10 million, but it's going to be above one. It'll be $3-5 million. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And I've got to the point where you want to hire me. This guy's a good guy. Thanks for coming in, Johnny. We really appreciate it. I think you can do the job. I know you're going to get on with the team. I understand you're looking for 150,000, and I only have 120 in the budget. But if you're prepared to accept that, then I'm going to make you a job offer. And you've got two choices. One, you can accept, and you just dropped your trousers to the tune of 30,000, which is expensive. Or you can fight. And when you fight, half the time you win and half the time you lose. And sometimes when you lose, you don't just lose the negotiation, you lose the entire job offer. So it's very dicey stuff. About 75% of people cave immediately and take it. They drop the trousers to 30,000 and the hiring manager wins straight off the bat. About half the remainder lose. All right. So about 87% of people fail the negotiation stage. And there are only two outcomes. One is they can pay you, or two is they can't. If they can't and you're worth it, pass. Okay? No, not every job is there to be accepted. All right? However, almost always, and I've sat in on these interviews, all right, so you just have to trust me that this is true, almost always, for a business of that kind of size where they're looking for a multi-million dollar win from somebody, it's not like they didn't have the other 30 grand this year. They didn't run out of money at break time today, right? They have the money. They've just chosen not to spend it. It's on someone's spreadsheet. It adds up really nice and neatly, and they don't want to change it. Well, that's not a good enough reason not to give you the money, all right? So you've got to give them a reason to give you the money, all right? And so my answer to that would be, Brandon, I appreciate that, and thank you for being honest with me. I think the person who can help you reduce your business costs by circa £5 million over the next 18 months, $5 million over the next 18 months, and bring home that win of restoring your competitive advantage and perhaps not being the subject of an acquisition because you're running the company a bit flabbily, would be worth at least £150,000 and probably more. For me, because this is a job I can do well and is in my sweet spot, which means, you know, I've further confirmed to you, you've nailed it, the bullseye, yeah? I'd be happy to do it for 150,000. I don't need to negotiate you guys up, yeah? And having, actually, there's an element prior to this, which comes out earlier on in the program, which is the range which you're looking for. And I would have given a range of 150 to 180 rather than a single number, okay? So now I'm back in the negotiation. So for me, you know, 150 to 180 for this kind of job is about normal. But I like you guys. I can do this job well. So I don't need to be hard-assed about it. I'm happy to do it for 150. And then you sit. All right. And you are worth it. You know, there's no way someone's going to pass on a $5 million win over the next 18 months to save $30,000 now. No hiring manager who's, you know, more senior enough to make a $150,000 hiring decision is dumb enough to pass on $5 million to save 30 grand now. No one in there said, but you do have to have that value proposition stacked up. It can't be about your 10 years of experience and your knowledge of finance 2.0 and your master's in finance, because there's loads of other candidates who can tick those boxes. It's about solving their problem at their level and making the pain that they've got, which might be, I fear being an acquisition target, or I fear being fired for, you know, allowing the cost to balloon out of control. whatever it is you've uncovered in the early interview process, you can solve that problem and bring home the win. And you just restate that. And that's worth $150,000.
Yeah. And I love the logic and the practicality, especially for a finance role. Yeah. And one of the things I found, and Jennifer, you might found this too, is a lot of times the higher it goes, the more emotional it gets. And so what I found at times with negotiation, which is interesting, was there is this dance you have to do at a very high level where you both have to negotiate what you're worth, because it's not okay to, you know, to use that very British term, I guess, drop your trousers, which I'm not familiar with, but I like it. But also not to say, I don't like you or I don't value you, because you'd be surprised how many times a C-suite executive is like, wait, they don't like us? Forget it. We don't like them. I'm like, we're not in kindergarten here, y'all. Like,
And you're right. And it's about setting it up beforehand, because virtually all negotiation isn't about the negotiation, that little conversation there. It's about the 9 steps prior. If you've read any big books on negotiation, I've swallowed a couple of huge ones, including one written by a guy from the FBI. Negotiation isn't about getting a win. It's not about having your combative head on. So your combative head, you can take that off. It's about collaboration. And if you ever watch a negotiation, particularly in the movies, they get some of the core elements of that right. It's about giving, let's say there's some terrorist with some hostages in a room. What you want to do is give that person a safe zone to work in. So whatever they do next, they can't screw it up, right? Whatever they do next is going to work out for them. So, and that salary range I've given you, 150 to 180, that's your safe zone. Anywhere in there, and you can't screw it up. Yeah. And so you're trying to give them some safe parameters to work within. So regardless of what direction they move in and whatever direction they move next, it will work out for them, which means that they feel safe leaving their entrenched position. Once you've got them moving, then you can send them in a direction. All right. So that's how negotiation is done. Obviously, I'm not an FBI negotiator, but I'm good enough to negotiate salary. I'll give you that much. And it's all about the value proposition during the interview, giving them a reason to want to hire you, and then saying the value of doing this job is X to Y, and I'll do it at X, X being the lower figure, the one you wanted anyway. So you've kind of negotiated yourself down $30,000 on their behalf already. And nobody who's going to let a $5 million, solution walk out the door for $30,000. That's never happened in my entire career.
If I may piggyback on that, Johnny, something I'd learned many, many years ago, I'm sure some of you out there might be familiar with things like Myers-Briggs and DISC profiling. One of the greatest attributes and tricks that I learned as a recruiter, both on the client and the job seeker side, and it's a very fine line of integrity that you have to walk, because you never want to manipulate people. But to your point, Brandon, a CEO will cut off his or her own nose to spite their face just because they don't even realize how they're designed as a human being, nor do we realize how we're designed. So many years ago, I'd read an article about something that was akin to DISC profiling, which is rubies, emeralds, sapphires, and pearls. And just from a 100,000-foot view perspective, a pearl is somebody who likes to be behind the scenes, who doesn't make change quickly. An emerald is someone who needs details and facts to feel secure. A ruby is somebody who's very CEO-like and wants it quick and down and dirty and fast, or they don't want it at all. And a sapphire cares about fun. Now, of course, we can see that we all have different aspects of all of us in that. And how you would negotiate with a ruby is totally different, for me at least, from the years I spent recruiting and researching and understanding this, than how you would negotiate with an emerald. So to your point, Johnny, if I was negotiating with an emerald, predominant emerald CEO, and you can tell by how many questions they ask, do they talk a lot? Are they more quiet? This is my favorite part of recruiting, is the psychological aspect of it. And if I were negotiating with an emerald, I would use your tactic, Johnny, where I would provide more facts to an emerald, 10 times more facts to an emerald. I would pause. I would give lots of time to digest, and I wouldn't necessarily try to close the deal that day. However, if I was interviewing with a high-level CEO ruby type who wanted it down, dirty, quick, I would do a takeaway from them. And I would actually just say, I appreciate it, but I actually have two other offers on the table. So thank you so much for your time. And it's so funny to watch because I've seen this happen. And you always have to do this from a place of integrity, which I really want to emphasize here. But you would literally see a CEO where whether or not they have the money, they would lose their minds. If you told the CEO that they couldn't have something that they thought they wanted and they were a predominant Ruby, they would pay 30,000 pounds or dollars more just to be able to receive that. But that's more the tactic of reading people, which I'm sure the FBI negotiator you mentioned is good at.
Yeah. And you're right. It's, you know, the economics of purchasing, actually I have that book behind me on my shelf. There's a reason why there's three sizes of cup in Starbucks. It's because if you've got more money in your pocket and you want to show that off to other people, you just buy a bigger cup. And that way you're the bigger cup person in the room. That's it. That's all it is. It's got nothing to do with the contents of the cup and everything to do with the size of the cup, because that's how people demonstrate status. You know, if you're behind the person in the queue and you just feel like, you know, you're a bit better than them, you're just going to buy the bigger one, right? Because you can. No one wants, you know, and they got busted for it years and years and years ago in the UK. We drink a lot of tea. And tea at Starbucks, which is one of the, you know, big selling drinks, all they were doing was putting it in a bigger cup, the same tea bag in the bigger cup, and pouring more water in it. They're actually selling weaker tea, you know, more diluted tea for more money because it was in a bigger cup. And it went on for years and years and years, this practice, because the people buying it didn't care about the quality of the tea. They wanted to be the big cup person. And you're right with the CEO. They're not going to be told they can't have something when, you know, if I'm hiring someone on 150,000, even if I'm not the CEO, I'm probably going to be on 250,000 or something like that. I have the authority to spend the money, all right? No one's going to tell me I can't. And if I want the $5 million win, I'm going to say, I gave the guy an extra 30,000 because he's going to bring in 5 million. And that's the kind of way I roll, because I'm a senior dude. That's you know, that I'm paid to make that call. And so, yeah, if you listen to people hard, which you don't have to succeed in an interview, but if you really listen to people hard, you can play that psychological game with them, you know? I want to help you bring home the $5 million win so that you can take that to your board rather than, yeah, we're on the back foot and defensive because we're, you know, we're not competitive in the marketplace. Yeah. Let's just change the story at board level. That's a personal win. It's got nothing to do with the company. That's everything to do about bragging rights at board level. If you know you've got that person, you can feed them that line.
So, Johnny, we did a show called The Year of the Pivot, and that idea of leveling up or figuring out what's next. So, as we sort of come to an end here, I'd love for you to go. We're big on threes here, power three. We do everything with threes. I know you're a seven guy. So I'm not going to, but if we can sort of just say, hey, look, someone is at their point in their career where they want to get the $60,000 job or the six figure job.
Yeah.
What are one, two, three things they should be doing?
We're coming to the end. I'm going to shill for myself now. Three things.
Shill, go.
I mentioned the ebook earlier, so we'll discount that. You've already got that. On the 23rd of September, I'm going to run a free LinkedIn masterclass. This is only for executives, and the link for that's in the group already. You can turn up for that, and I will spill the beans on how to optimize a profile for anyone who's a six-figure job seeker. You're going to get a ton of value out of that. Also, I've got a $550 LinkedIn optimization program, which I'm going to give away that day. Somebody's going to win it on the day. I'm just going to name them on the day and give it to them. So you can turn up for that. On the 27th, the following Monday, I'm running a free five-day job seeking accelerator. Again, only for executives. I've done a dozen or so of these, and it's always been wildly popular. We have hundreds of people come on it. And we actually do the first two steps of the entire program, positioning and messaging. So you'll take away with you your elevator pitch, your executive summary, your banner for your LinkedIn profile, and your headline. By the Friday. It takes about 5 minutes to 30 minutes a day. Plus, there's an optional Ask Me Anything session, which you can turn up to or not. I tend to do it with a cup of tea and give away tons of value. So they're always worth turning up to. So you get onto the masterclass, then you come to the accelerator. And if at the end of that, you think, wow, that guy from England, he really knows his stuff, then you can choose to continue to work with me. That's not free. That's your third thing. And I run a program called the Get Found, Get Hired program. It's from Executive Edge. I founded it. It's several thousand dollars, but it is definitive. It comes with a 100% money back guarantee. Whether you do or don't do that is entirely up to you. I don't do a hard sales pitch because I think you should get bought instead. So either you buy me or you don't. It's up to you. Your grown-ups will treat you like that. There you go. There's your three things.
Boom. Well done. Boom. Johnny, what do people think about Ted Lasso in England? It's a total non sequitur, just like obsessive it over here.
Say that again.
Ted Lasso. Is anyone watching it in England? Because we're obsessive it in America.
No, it's not. Not
well. Not see that? See, we're all obsessive. You guys are not even obsessive. Us. It's so sad.
Ah, bless. My favorite American TV show is The West Wing, which is a huge smash hit all over. And there's an interesting character on there called Toby Ziegler, who was the president's chief speechwriter. And he was all about the audience. And that's the number one thing I take away from this. Getting a job, a successful job, is not about you. It's about the person who wants to buy you. And if you boil that entire thing down, yes, I'm in a global award winner, digital marketing and executive set, all the rest of the things. It's not about that. It's not about any of those things. It's not even about the 7-step program. It's about one word, empathy. Mm-hmm. If you can see the world through the other person's eyes, which as a job seeker means the hiring manager's eyes, and give them what they need, take away their problem and their pain, they'll buy it, whether or not you match the job description or not. All right, you may not be able to tick all the boxes, but if you can solve all the problems and take all the pain away, they'll pay you anyway. And that's all about them. And so you've got to get the conversation onto them. That's empathy. And there was a brilliant character in The West Wing who did that so, so well. He hardly ever talked about, you know, the administration and the government of the day. He talked to the audience about them. And that's how you get the vote. That's how you get your boss to give you the budget. And that's how you get hired. It's always about the other person.
I love that. I mean, it's a great show, and it's a great point about empathy, compassion. And I think that is a commodity in this post-COVID world where we're all isolated and alone. We want people to see us and feel us and hear us, especially Gen Z and all these coming generations. They care about that even more so. With the show that I like, which is about American guy taking over a football team, there's a great scene in an English pub, and the big takeaway is be curious, not judgmental. Get curious about someone. And I just love it. It's just that's a whole principle. And he talks about his ethos of life is that he was always curious, but he met all these people that were judgmental. And I think that if you take that approach and you get curious about what Johnny's talking about today, what Jennifer talks about all the time, that's the secret. Not judging someone by their shoes, pun intended, because it happened when Johnny saw.
Yeah.
But to act really curious and empathetic towards an individual, that's a commodity. And then by all means, you can do the 7 steps. It's going to make you the secure job. And I love what Johnny said. Then you can choose the place, right? Your boss.
Yeah. Look, we have data at our end, because I'm a data freak, that between 5% and 15% of your market are looking for you at any one time. That does depend on how senior you are. If you're the CEO, it's probably nearer 5% than if you're a VP. And the narrowness of your market, if you want to work in financial services, big fat market, if you want to work in beekeeping, that's probably quite narrower. And also the nature of the job, you know. If you're in the pharmaceutical industry and you want to be in finance, fine. There's a whole floor of those people. If you want to be the head of genome mapping, yeah, that's going to be nearer 5% than 15%. So there's some variables there, but it's between, you know, those two numbers there. So if you picked on 20 firms that you particularly want to work for, that we know between 1 and 3 of those firms, 5 to 15% of 20, are trying to find someone like you right now. Wouldn't it be great to be on the radar of those people so that they can choose to buy you? So you end up in an interview, not just for your core purpose, but at a firm you really want to work for. That's an absolute gift. And so we'll show you how to identify the name of your name. Actually, you better name your next boss before they even know you exist. And then it's not about a sales pitch. You know, send them an email. My CV's attached. Have you got a job? Blah, blah, blah. They're not interested in that. What they want to know is what's in it for them. Yeah, I can help you insert purpose as measured by insert performance. And if that's the problem you have right now, then let me know. No CV attached. And 85 to 95%, 17 to 19 firms are going to completely ignore you. But 1 to 3, you're going to get an email back going, that's interesting. That's our problem today. Can you come in and talk to us, please? you know, boom.
Right. Wow, this has been one of my favorite interviews we've done in a long time. I think you give people so many substantive tips, Johnny, to walk away. And what a gift, you know, the universe. It just, I believe in synchronicities and things always working out for our highest and best good. And I love that we had an opening and you were available. So it all.
Happy to be here. Talking with an executive networking group in Chicago earlier today. I'm going to be talking with another one. What are we doing? St. Louis, that's Missouri, right?
Yeah.
And Nashville. So I'm all over the East Coast, down the Eastern Seaboard. helping you guys out. Well, where are you guys based? LA Talk Radio? Do I take a cue from that? Are you West Coast?
Yeah, but Jennifer's in Lisbon and I'm in Oakland, so you know. but we met in LA, and that's where our amazing studio is
based. Yeah. There's a British firm in the groceries industry called Tesco, and that opened up its US international subsidiary. I can't remember the name of it now. It was something cheesy like Fresh and Green or something like that. And they opened a whole ton of international stores. A lot of it's on the West Coast. And we had the head of supply chain for that business on the West Coast come on and do a masterclass for us post-COVID, which was a really interesting one. So I'm all about the weather in LA though. I've seen the pictures. It looks good.
Everybody, you need to go check out everything Johnny has offered us. We're going to have it in the show notes. You can find it on Facebook or on LA Talk Radio or iTunes, Amazon Music. You can find it on our iHeartRadio, so many places that you'll be able to find all of the incredible free gifts that Johnny Walker has offered us today. And I'm excited. I was going to announce today. I know we're at the end of the show, going a few minutes over, but I have been working for the last year with my dear friend and mentor and vocal coach, Arthur Samuel Joseph, who worked with Sean Connery and Tony Robbins, Dwayne Wade, and many others. And so we actually just launched our program a day ago, and it's called Command Your Destiny. And if anybody's interested in finding out more about it, it's an 11-week process of how to command your destiny using just what we were talking about today, which is your voice. So you can go to vocalawareness.com/yes to find out more. And everybody, this is the first time we're introducing it. So you can put in intro 20, all in caps, and get 20% off if you're interested. So we're so grateful to be launching this. And thank you to Johnny for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, cheers, everyone. Have a great week.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill and Brandon Maslin, only on LA Talk Radio.